Rob's not actually here. This is Dan Morrison from Art of the Possible. Just means that we're going to have that much more of an engaging conversation today. This is Art of the Possible with Dan Morrison and Rob Page, where we talk about how people make things happen, how they make life happen, how they make business happen, how they make culture happen. And actually today I have the great privilege of having a wonderful guest, Rosie Von Lilly. I want to make sure, I always get worried about your last name. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You were very close. It's Von Lila.
There we go. Even see, Von Lila sounds so much better when you say it than when I say it anyway. Rosie, thank you for joining today. It looks like you have some interesting background and surroundings. Where are you?
Dan, thank you so much for having me here today. It's great to be with you. And Rob, you're here in spirit. I am today in remote Northern California. We are traveling the country in a 1964 Chevy pickup truck with a camper on the back of it. And it's been 10 days so far, and it has been an adventure, we'll say.
In 10 of how many days?
6 weeks.
Wow. Okay. And how many people are on this trip?
Two and a chihuahua.
Two and a chihuahua, and a unicorn, saw a unicorn.
So I'm feeling very American today. We have been staying at different campgrounds so far, and it's a really cool way to see the country, and it's also a really amazing way to connect with American people, travelers. We were just camping next to a group of Russian guys, and a few days ago we stayed at a campground with a guy who, so I was walking to the camper and a guy came out. This was like at 7 a.m. Nobody was up yet. A guy came out of the bathroom, not wearing a shirt, completely covered in tattoos, like a full shirt of tattoos all the way up his head and his face. And he was bald. And
sounds like that movie. Was it like the movie Eastern Promises with Viggo Mortensen? And he's like the Russian mafia guy covered in all these tattoos.
Well, I'll tell you, I didn't say hello to him. And then when I realized he was staying in the camper right next to us, like that's like a campground faux pas. You say hi to your neighbors. And so I didn't say hi. And then I was in my head about it. And then like a couple hours later, he and David are chatting each other up about the pickup truck, because he's like, this thing gets looks and people talk about it and want to know about it. And then he turned his back, and across his low back, it said White Pride. And my mouth literally fell open. And what's really cool about traveling the country in this way is that I have the opportunity to interact with people, all kinds of people. And I regret not having been able to have a conversation with him and actually like ask him about it, because I wonder if it's, I know a guy named Christian Piccolini, who in the 1980s, when he was a young teenager, was instrumental in growing the white power movement in this country, and he regrets it. And so now he's one of the leading experts on how to extract people from the white power movement. And so I was curious if this guy was still in that, or if he was, if it was something that he regretted. The point is that traveling this way, staying at campgrounds, you get to meet all different kinds of people.
Absolutely. It's funny. Rob was actually telling me a story the other day where he had a very similar experience. Him and his son go motocross riding. And so they hooked up the trailer. They were staying at some campground, and they just started engaging with this other family. And it turned out that, they were different than Rob. Like, right, I love Rob. And the reason why Rob and I are such good friends and partners is that we actually are like an odd couple, right? And so he's a very kind of traditional Republican. I'm a very traditional Democrat, although he did not vote for Trump. And so he gets into this conversation with this family, and they're big, big Trump supporters. And he says, he's like, I never, ever, ever would have had that conversation with those people. But when you're at a campground, when there's fire and a barbecue and like these things happening, it finally gives this space where you actually can have these conversations that we typically don't. So
100%. Now, the reason I brought that up, I didn't finish that story, ties back to the unicorn.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We're in our camper and they're packing up, and I hear them say, I think we're going to leave the unicorn, which I don't know what they're talking about at the time. A few hours later, we come out, they've left. there's an inflatable floaty unicorn to go on the river. So, and they left an oar. So we go out on the unicorn, two big adults on this floating unicorn with the Chihuahua, and we ended up adopting it. So now it's traveling the country with us.
Well, if that's not a compelling, interesting, captivating way to start a podcast, why don't you give us a little bit of, I love your background. We were introduced through a mutual friend, Michael Slaby, who was on this podcast. And he's like, you got to meet Rosie. And so we chatted, and I think I'll let you, we're going to get into your story. But for the listeners, what was why we knew this was going to be an amazing conversation with an amazing person, because the terms Burning Man and private equity were said in the same sentence. And I think that's one of the things that I'm very curious to dig around it. But who the hell are you?
Yeah, I think the one word that describes my background is unconventional. So I am someone who grew up with a mom who always encouraged me to be whomever I want to be. And she embraced whatever things I wanted to try or didn't want to try. And I was introduced to the world of Burning Man when I was 19 and living in San Francisco. And I started going and became hooked on it, so much so that it became a huge part of my life. And I started a festival inspired by it. I eventually started working for Burning Man headquarters, and I got to travel the world as a representative for the organization and write speeches for some of the founders. And it's, I've been involved with it now for over 20 years. I've attended 19 times, and I moved to New York in my early 30s, and I started working in finance, which was an absolute lark. It was through the encouragement of someone that I knew who said, you know, your skill set is fully transferable to this industry. And so I gave it a go and worked on building an investment firm focused on regenerative infrastructure, and ended up not doing that. We didn't move it forward, but I worked on it for several years and continue to work in the finance industry, although I've left it full time now.
So a bunch of stuff to ask now. Just for our listeners, I actually mentioned Burning Man to a friend the other day, and they actually didn't know what it was. And I decided not to pass judgment. But give our listeners a little, how would you describe Burning Man and what it is?
So it started almost 35 years ago, and it has grown to be this annual event that takes place in Northern Nevada. There are about 80,000 people who go, but that's really one part of it. It's an event, it's a global network, and it's a culture. And so Burning Man is in almost, well, the original event is, there's one of them, and it's in Nevada. These regional events have grown from that, and there's over 160 regional events around the world in almost 50 countries. And so there are hundreds of thousands of people who have attended. There are millions of people who are connected to the culture, and the culture is based on generosity, participation, and creativity. And I was talking with one of the six co-founders recently, and we were sharing that a critic once described, I would say a hipster critic once described Burning Man as having gone from this anarchistic, wild, and totally free space to now being a civil service organization, kind of like the Boy Scouts, where it churns out good neighbors. And this co-founder laughed. And she said, you know, I think that's kind of true. And I think that it's something that's so needed now, because much like what you were sharing in the relationship that you have with Rob and how you two have political differences, different ways to see the world, that is also true of the people who go to Burning Man. There are people across the political spectrum. And what unites us all is that we're humans. We love creativity. We love having the free space to create and play together. And it's a remarkable training ground for people who want to explore their edges and who are interested in becoming self-reliant and at the same time, catalyzing community.
And so if one of the listeners who isn't familiar with Burning Man actually went, like, how would you describe the experience?
Infinitely diverse. So it's different for every single person. There are a million plus infinities ways to go to Burning Man and to do Burning Man. I, in the almost 20 times that I've been, I've camped every which way. I've camped in every kind of vehicle. When I first went, I stayed in a tent. There were some years where I rented a station wagon or a cargo van or a box truck. Eventually I had an RV. The last time that I went, we took my mom and we got a really big fancy RV that we borrowed from a friend. So there's a million ways to do it. There's a million things that you can do there. Art projects you can create, art cars you can be involved with. You can volunteer. There's over, I think, 10,000 volunteers during the week of Burning Man. And it is a literal city where there are services that are all provided for free by people because it's their passion and it's fun. So if you want to find a nightclub or a day bar, that exists. If you want to find an AA meeting, that exists. If you want to find a place to learn about energy healing, that exists. If you want to talk about just everything, it exists out there.
Brilliant. And it's dusty. That's what I've heard. I've heard it's very dusty.
So it takes place in the largest flat place in North America, which is the Black Rock Desert. It's 400 square miles in the morning. This is the one of two places that I've ever experienced absolute stillness. Not during Burning Man. I was out there at a different time. So in the morning, it's completely quiet. And then as the sun heats up the earth, by the afternoon, the winds pick up. And it dislodges all of this really fine clay dust. And so everybody gets this very beautiful patina on their skin. It gets into everything. It's utterly corrosive. And, but it's like part of the experience. You just become one with it.
Yeah. I love it. I remember we had a meeting with Guitar Center and their Guitar Center executives and the CEO of Profit, Michael Dunn, who's a dear friend and mentor of mine, came directly from Burning Man, and he still had like dust all over his suit. Everything was perfect. It's perfect. I've a lot of like dear friends that have gone. And to me, it actually represents the art of the possible, almost in a very literal way, because, there are these massive installations, right? I mean, like people, it's part builder's fair as well. Is that correct?
Entirely. The maker movement has very much been inspired by and driven by the Burning Man community. And there's what I fell in love with and what hooked me was that every single year I had the opportunity to explore whatever I wanted to explore, create whatever I wanted to create. Who do I want to be this year at Burning Man and play as during this week? And so there are so many sophisticated engineers, architects, lighting experts, designers, just it's unfathomable. And you can look at pictures and you can look at videos, but it is no substitute for actually experiencing the largeness of these sculptures. And over the course of the last three decades, Burning Man art has become a category of art that is recognized in the art industry. And that what Burning Man art is it's large scale art that's collaboratively produced. It's not something that a single artist can make. It requires a team, a community of people to create it together because it's so large.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of friends with their kids are there and they bring the whole family and the kids are climbing up on the art and all those things. And it's pretty amazing. So now, and let's talk in let me be inappropriate and talking stereotypes, right? So here's this like kind of Burning Man, hippie, free spirit kind of environment, right? Now going to, kind of a Wall Street kind of very conservative, like buttoned up, talk about the art of the possible and being like not defining yourself and actually being open to the ability to move and maneuver in different worlds. Like take us through that. Cause that's a novel move that anyone would have expected.
I think that, I certainly didn't expect it either. And one very pivotal moment was somebody else seeing something that was possible. It took that person saying to me, your skill set is transferable to this industry, to have me think, ah, maybe that is possible. And I've said this for years, that going from Burning Man to Wall Street, costuming is a very big part of Burning Man if you want to explore with that. You don't have to. But for me, I've loved it since the very beginning. And putting on a business suit and wearing pearls has, for me, for the last 6 years, been a part of wearing a costume. I've heard Arlen Hamilton, who is a venture capitalist and who is most comfortable in purple sneakers and a hoodie, says that if she put on a suit, it would feel like a costume to her. I get that for her, that feels inauthentic. For me, wearing a costume is very much a part of my authentic expression. That's really what I think fashion is. And so rather than, you know, I got to a point where I was able to start affording having my suits made. And I didn't just go and like choose a pre-made pattern. I actually designed my suit and I found a dressmaker who could make my pattern specifically for me. And I have selected all of my materials, my fabrics, my buttons, and they're meaningful to me. Like I have silks, like my suits are lined with silk. My suits are wool. I choose all of these. I pick buttons out when I go and I travel. And so for me, every time I wear those, it's a work of art that is part of my expression. And yeah, I think I'll leave that there.
Well, and it's fascinating, right? Because in a way, I'm assuming it sets a mindset. Does it set a mindset? How does the physicalness of the costume and everything then interact with the mental state by which you're in?
For sure. So I want to say one thing before I share a story, which is that Burning Man has given me the opportunity to be trained and practiced in connecting with anyone. So it doesn't matter the context, whether I'm camped next to somebody who has a white pride tattoo, or I'm meeting with a US senator, I see them as a human being and I'm curious about them. And it's very easy for me to build rapport with people in that way. Now, wearing a suit is, you know, those are all costumes that we wear in the culture of business. And when you dress certain ways, I realized this experientially. I mean, there's the adage, dress for success. It's very much a truism. I was at the Senate building. I was at the U.S. Senate building a few years ago, and I was there for a conference. I was dressed to the nines in my suit and the pearls and everything. And I was sitting at the front of the room and I had to get up and use the restroom. Now, when I looked behind me before I got up, it was filled with tables that were packed with people. And it was going to be really hard to squeeze through all these people. My only option was to go to the front, further to the front of the room, and exit through the door where all the senators who had been speaking were coming. And so that went back to the green room. So I stood up like I belonged there. And because I was wearing a suit and looked like I did, nobody said anything. As I walked past these senators and I walked into the green room, and Eva Longoria was there that day. She was speaking about something. And I just walked right through and I went and did what I needed to do. But there is, you know, dressing in a way that's culturally appropriate for whatever environment you're in. It opens up doors for sure.
In I'm assuming, or maybe this is a bad assumption, that how is, like, when you get into these conversations, you're in your suit, right? You're in your costume, you're on Wall Street. And then when you start interacting with the Wall Street crowd, and I'm stereotyping here again, how do they react to the whole Burning Man story? Like, how are you received?
I was discreet about it for quite a while. And then I remember just a couple of years ago, I was facilitating a meeting with about 40 people sitting around a huge table. And these were pension fund managers and pension consultants. Like, these are people whose companies manage hundreds of billions of dollars. Some of them manage trillions of dollars. Like, these are some of the largest pools of capital that are under management. And I was leading an organization at that time that was facilitating the meeting. And I, in passing, mentioned to the room in my opening remarks something about Burning Man. I don't remember why, and I still can't believe that I did it. But somebody came up to me afterward, and they're like, "You used to work for Burning Man? That's so cool." And I think that there's being professional and polished, and then also being real and authentic about who you are, is something that's very important. But I will say that for a long time, I separated artist Rosie from business Rosie. And I, when I decided to leave finance full time last year, I started weaving those two pieces together. And it was like my fabric was for myself was finally complete. I'm more interested in being fully real about the wholeness of who I am rather than fitting in, I suppose.
So I'm always very interested in kind of transformation moments and transformation moments people go through like yours. And if this gets too personal, you don't have to answer this question, but what was it like emotionally is when you made that decision of actually, you know what, I don't have to segment. I can actually weave this together. I can actually be my whole self. What was that like?
At first, there was trepidation. And then the more that I did it, the more it's been embraced. And the more powerful I feel in myself. Last year during COVID, I was at a transition point in my career, and the next step was either going to be to go work at a private equity or venture capital firm and work on their investor relations team and perhaps lead an investor relations team, or it was going to be something else. And when I looked at the industry and the firms that I was interested in working at, there were less than a handful of firms that I wanted to work at. And while all of the turmoil was happening in 2020, social turmoil, political turmoil, the pandemic, I realized that what was most important to me was to be able to use my voice fully and not have to filter. And I thought about if I was working for a company and representing a company, that I would have to filter my voice. And so that was when I decided to no longer work full-time in finance, because I want to have the full autonomy with my voice and be able to opine on anything that's important to me and be real with people. And so I've come to realize that all of this diverse experience, ranging from Burning Man to working in finance and coaching people and all of this, and like speaking around the world, I wrote a framework on stakeholder engagement. How do you build participatory culture? All of these things tie into creating human flourishing. And so that's what I'm doing now, is I'm taking all of these threads from my background and I'm developing a model for how do we create mass human flourishing.
Tell me more.
So let's see, I'm writing a book about it. It'll be out early in 2022. And I have been saying that, you know, we focus so much attention on the future and building a better future. And what that kind of thinking does is it has us be anywhere but present. And the future lives in our imagination. And that is a wonderful thing, where we get to invent in our minds what we create. But it's created in the here and now every day, in our actions that we take, inspired by that vision. And so mass human flourishing, which is the ability for everybody to meet their basic needs and to effectively have the opportunity to self-actualize as a human being. In order for that to happen, what it takes is us being present here now. Human flourishing doesn't happen in the future. It happens now, here, today. And I was thinking about this morning, because I read a post by Edward Snowden last night about a new policy that Apple is going to be instituting for the iPhone. And Snowden's critique, and it's not just his critique, it's you know, people who are anti-surveillance, is saying that it's effectively making it so that your photo content is entirely accessible by Apple, and what they're scanning for is, you know, certain illegal material. He said the problem with this is that who decides what's illegal? He says it gives the government carte blanche to tell Apple, okay, now we want you to search for this kind of anti-government material. And so he said this is a Pandora's box. And so I woke up this morning thinking about, am I going to quit my iPhone in the same way that I quit Facebook a number of years ago, in the same way that I quit WhatsApp earlier this year? Am I going to quit the iPhone? And I'm just about to a yes on that. What I was reflecting on today is what happened when I quit Facebook. And there has been, and WhatsApp as well, there's definitely been some isolation. But the benefit of what it's created in my life is more creativity, more space and presence, more well-being, more actual connection with real people that I really care about. And it catalyzes me to actually build those real relationships. And so I find myself moving, regressing from my very like technological way of life and working with all these apps every day and thinking about what will it be like to simplify? And is that an access point to my flourishing? And I'll tell you that quitting Facebook definitely was an access to my flourishing.
Yeah. What a beautiful term, human flourishing. And so you're calling it mass human flourishing. Is that, that's
yes.
It. Where does that come from? Like, where does that term come from? It's an amazing term.
Oh, thank you. It arose earlier this year when I started writing a book. I was, for a long time, I've lived with that idea that everybody has at least one book in them. Now, for me, somebody with so many interests and who's done so many things, as I was having trouble deciding what I was going to write about. So I was talking to a friend who used to run business development for a big publishing house. And I said, well, I'm thinking about this as a book topic or this as a book topic. And I laid out three things. And I said, really, what connects all of them together is human flourishing. And it was like lightning struck. And he goes, that's what your book is about. And I was like, oh, okay. And so human flourishing isn't just for the wealthy. It isn't just for people in the West. It isn't just for a specific part of humanity. Flourishing is our birthright. And being in the Homo sapiens species and being on this planet, it is our birthright to be connected with nature and enjoy the abundance of it. It is our birthright to get to create in the way that all of us who go to Burning Man do. Like, that is available to us. And one of the things that I love that Burning Man is an example of is it shows us that there is another way of living where people can treat each other well, no matter what our differences are, and that we can work through conflicts and that we are capable of extraordinary accomplishments. And that is available to everyone if we choose it. And it's not available in the future. It's available now.
That's beautiful. And I think it's even just as a word like flourish is, I think, something that everyone gets and everyone kind of can buy into. Like, yeah, do we want to flourish? Yes, we want to flourish. And I want to flourish in my family. I want to flourish, you know, in my work, like not necessarily my like business work, but just my work as a person and the work I'm doing in life. And so I love that concept. And so you said early 2022, it's coming out.
Yeah, I'm
are you done? Are you finished? Or are you?
No, I am doing what Elizabeth Gilbert said she does in one of her TED Talks. She said she shows up every day like a mule and she works. And sometimes divine genius shows up to assist her and sometimes it doesn't. And so I am doing that work every single day. And it's a practice of discipline. I love the word discipline in terms of its root being disciple, to follow. And I love this idea that every no is a yes to something else. I was just reflecting on this morning. The question is, are the no's in your life supporting what you care about? Or are they holding you back from what you care about? And so I'm working away on it. I am intending for it to be done by this year so I can do a several months tour at the beginning of next year.
Well, fantastic. Well, when that comes out, make sure you let us know. We'll make sure we do everything we can to help you support that.
Thank you, Dan.
And continue to chop wood and carry water. That's the mantra of writing. Like, you just got to chop wood and carry water and get it done. So,
that's right.
But Rosie, it's been fantastic having you on the show. I love your story. I think, human flourishing, I wish you the most human flourishing possible for you. And I cannot wait to read the book and share that with everybody in our audience. And thank you for sharing some of your life with us today.
Thank you, Dan. Right back at you.
Fantastic. Well, this is Art of the Possible with Rob Page and Dan Morrison. I think today was a great conversation, or a reason to follow us and subscribe and listen to some other great podcasts that we have. And until next time, we'll see you all soon.